Ravel's cheerful Alborada del Grazioso opens the final program of the Huntsville Symphony Orchestra. What an exciting program. I mean, it's like ordering something from a restaurant and getting the most perfect plate of food. This beautiful lineup of music. Pleased to welcome back Gregory Voita.
Hello there.
So where do you even start? I know I ask you this every time, but you've got this really super exciting main course, the Rite of Spring. So how do you plan around that?
You know, it happened to me not once that somehow the program I put together was proved to be more wise than its maker, that would be me. And as I was just writing a blog, about this upcoming concert, and I realized that these pieces were all written around the same time. And I'm not saying that's something that holds them together, but probably for some reason, there was something in the air. And we know what. I mean, The Rite of Spring was written in 1913, and, you know, First World War happened in 1914. Mm-hmm. Alborada del Grazioso as a piano piece was composed in 1905 and orchestrated in 1922, so after the World War, right? So the mm-hmm. First World War kind of broke everything into half. The Shumanovsky violin concerto is... also was premiered in the 20s, but was written in 1916. So we're talking about these pieces here that were all written around the same time, somehow kind of like getting the energy from, you know, from whatever was in the air back then. And of course, the greatest example of that is Rite of Spring, that mm-hmm. Although it's not about war, but it has a lot of, you know, a lot of blood in it, so to say, in the storyline and the way it's written and something that nobody has ever heard before.
And there's also another link, the Diaghilev connection, because the Rite of Spring was staged by Serge Diaghilev, but also Alborada del Grazioso was also made into a ballet.
Well, both pieces, yeah. Of course, are great for ballet. I mean, mm-hmm. they're very, you know, the rhythm is very important, the groove and the characters are just perfect for that type of ballet that Diaghilev was doing with the Russian ballet.
And an Alborada also translates to obad, a song sung at dawn, and a grazioso is a jester. So it's this friendly little perky welcoming piece to begin the concert.
Yes, but if you listen to it, that you know, there is something going on there, just like Laval's, if you remember the great mm-hmm. Other great Ravel composition, that's also is perfect for choreography or for dance. And yes, it is a waltz, but. There is something
it
going
kind of
on there.
It pulls apart at the seams. Yeah,
yeah, it's not your, you know, all happy, let's dance
it's not
in
Strauss.
The ballroom.
Yeah.
It's not Strauss. And this Alborada del Grazioso, which is part of the Mirrors series for piano, also there is something in there that I'm not saying like, I'm foreseeing the future, the First World War is coming. That's not what I'm saying. But it's a 20th century composition that is kind of using this whole Spanish voice as a disguise, if you wish, or you know, just writing something that is not necessarily coming from the original tradition of these type of pieces, but definitely, you know, Diaghilev himself was very, very modern for the age. I mean, mm-hmm. that type of dancing that he invented, the choreography and all these ideas about these crazy stories like Rite of Spring. I mean, come on,
yeah.
That is really something moving away, way away from the so-called traditional ballet.
And this, the violin piece that's on the program that will be performed by Philip Quint, who's kind of a big deal.
You know, he's a big deal, yeah,
big
and
deal.
I like working with him.
Yeah, he's been nominated for a Grammy. He was nominated for a Grammy Award for the Korngold Violin Concerto that Carlos Miguel Prieto conducted. I'm looking forward to hearing him play this Shimanovsky. And Shimanovsky is somebody who doesn't get a whole lot of airtime here, especially at WLRH. If you look at our tracking sticky notes, the last time this was played was 1994.
Wow, okay.
So why not? Why are we neglecting this piece?
You know, sometimes there's just no explanation. Sometimes it's this whole, you know, so-called core repertoire just driven by personal taste of conductors and violinists. And I got to tell you that there are quite a few videos available on YouTube. I was surprised, actually, how many different ones of Shumanovsky Violin Concerto No. 1, which probably is the most well-known and probably the most performed composition of Szymanowski. He's got a lot of other things. I really like his music. It's kind of, you know, like Richard Strauss with a twist. I'm not saying with a Polish twist, but I'm mm-hmm. saying that, yes, it's also in there. But there is something really modern about Szymanowski, yet you can clearly hear the line of the tradition that he's continuing there with his music, and this is a strange piece in a good way, because it has all these romantic or late romantic qualities that we all love when we're listening to a violin concerto. Yet it's very cleverly written. It's a one movement piece, really. It's 27 minutes of a capriccio for violin, where you just move back and forth between slow and fast parts, and there is also a waltz, of course, in it, because you can do it with that. But this is something I think that is worth much more attention. Or I'm happy to contribute if I can by programming this to the rediscovery of Szymanowski's music, because it is worth it. I think it's really great music.
Which portion do you want to hear?
Well, why don't we just hear the very beginning? I guess that's the staple of the concerto anyway, the way it starts, and you immediately hear this impressionistic but romantic language that is Szymanowski's own.
I was telling Gregory Voida, this gets almost no airplay here at WLRH, but listening to it before this interview, I thought, well, why not? Why aren't we playing this? It's lovely. It's not inaccessible.
Yeah.
It's described as ethereal.
It is ethereal. A lot of playing in the very, very high range for the violin. And again, it's just a compact piece that, you know, shows what a violinist can do. Yet, as you heard, the orchestra is also playing a lot of music. There are a lot of notes and colors, and I just love this piece.
It sounded to me a lot like chamber music.
Yes, very much so. Yes, all the little sections of the orchestra, little solos everywhere, and somehow nobody creates these sound colors than Szymanowski can do. I think that's really his own. Like, the way you can recognize his music is by the sound colors.
And how do you combine the colors? I know Philip Quint has this in his repertoire, and your musicians are rehearsing it on their own. Do you change your approach to it when the soloist takes the stage and begins rehearsal?
Well, first of all, there is always a meeting between the conductor and the soloist before we all try to put together everything with the orchestra and the solo player being present. But also, it changes. I mean, music is about listening, right? Mm-hmm. When you hear something, mm-hmm. you react to it, and you have to react to it like right away. Some things just work because musicians hear something and they react to it because that's the way we are trained. But also that's what you do at rehearsal. It's like, oh, well, okay, he's playing it this way, so why don't we just all do that? Or maybe it's a bowing question, you know, mm-hmm, that comes up, mm-hmm. and the solution very often comes from what the soloist is actually doing.
Will he be at the rehearsal, the open rehearsal?
He will be at the open rehearsal.
You can actually see how that process works.
Oh yes, it's always the exciting part of the open rehearsal, right?
I agree. And that is at 11 o'clock on Saturday morning. There's a nominal charge to get in, but then you can come to the big exciting event, which is the concert, which begins at 7:30. It's Saturday, April the 22nd at the Mark C. Smith Concert Hall, the final concert of the HSO's 61st season?
63rd.
Whatever.
I don't know. WLR age is 40 years old. That's all I know. It says right here.
I gave you a coffee
on this
cup.
Mug.
That's how he knows. Well, the violin concerto is sort of airy and ethereal, and then we're brought right back down to earth real hard.
Or under the earth.
Yes. In the next section of the next half of the concert with the Rite of Spring. Wow. Where do you even start to talk about the Rite of Spring?
I think you start talking about that it's over 100 years old now, right?
And we're still talking about it.
Yeah, and it has never lost, you know, the energy. It's always exciting. It's always difficult. It's always a challenge for orchestras, for any orchestra, any conductor. But what's amazing is that, just think about it. I mean, come on, it's more than 100 years old, and you know, we still consider it like the big modern piece for orchestra. Yet, I got to tell you that it has become part of the core rep. So we have to recognize that this thing, what happens with pieces that start off with, you know, a big scandal, mostly because audience members were so loud that the dancers couldn't hear what the orchestra was playing, and also because it was so very, very new type of material for orchestras to play.
And we have to talk about the riot, because people hear Rite of Spring and they think riot. It wasn't the music itself. It was the whole event. It was a ballet. It wasn't a regular symphony concert like we're going to experience on Saturday. It was a ballet that opened with Les Sylphides. It was the lovely Ballet Blanc, the ladies in the tutus dancing to Chopin, and that's how it opens. So that's what people were expecting. And then here comes the Rite of Spring, which is something completely different. It's like going to the movies and having a Winnie the Pooh cartoon followed by Psycho. It's just, people were just confused by it, because the choreography was ugly, but in their mind, it wasn't the pretty ladies in tutus. They were wearing these native costumes. And you can find a reenactment on YouTube. The Joffrey Ballet did one. The dancers were turned in, and they were hunched over, and it wasn't the spectacle that they were experiencing. Oh, yeah, and the music was kind of weird.
So, yeah, it started like that, right? And now it's one of the cornerstones of the orchestra repertoire. So it does happen, you know. If you try to compare music that orchestras can play nowadays compared to what orchestras could play back in the day, then there's a huge jump.
Especially for the bassoon.
Yes, especially.
There were
bassoon
rights activists in the audience. That's what started the riot.
Oh, that must be it. All the 3.5 people on this planet who care about the rights of bassoon players. And I'm saying that coming from a more than half bassoonist family. But the famous solo at the beginning, that was also a very new idea to use the bassoon in this range. Probably because of the difficulty and because of the strangeness of it, it didn't sound at all like a bassoon. And now it's a repertoire for auditions, and everybody is, all their lives, as Hannah Thomas, our principal bassoonist, said, you know, this is just something you always practice. You try reeds and you would play this as, if I can play this with this reed.
Yes, he posted a video of himself playing. He's very excited about it. I guess nobody had heard a bassoon do that before. So there was that. Then there was the weird choreography. And then there's some speculation that the whole riot might have been staged. It could have been like the original fake news.
Well, it worked, I guess.
I know, because here we are still talking about it.
We're still talking about it. But it wouldn't have worked if the piece itself wasn't such a great, you know, composition. And as I was just listening to it, like, it's not only the bassoon, it's everybody else playing all kinds of sounds and colors that nobody has ever heard before, or nobody has ever written anything like that before, just using instruments like the piccolo clarinet mixed with the alto flute. So it's like a big flute and a small clarinet, and then there's the bass trumpet that plays at points. I mean, it wasn't new, because Wagner used bass trumpet, but not in this way. So everything that Stravinsky touched in this piece has turned into something else, something revolutionary, something that really nobody has ever thought of before. And I think that's partly or mainly the reason for the riot, and mm-hmm. the reason for why we consider this a major piece.
Yeah, at one point, Diaghilev had to flip the lights off and on, and Nijinsky, who did the choreography, was shouting the steps to the dancers because they couldn't hear, because people were yelling and throwing their snacks onto the stage. But once the ballet was removed, and Pierre Monteau was the conductor, once they did it in a concert setting, it was very popular. It wasn't that scary anymore.
Well, it wasn't played for years, though. I mean, well, one of the reasons was probably World War One, because, you know, pretty much everything in this format anyway stopped. Stravinsky himself wrote Soldier's Tale later, because musicians were either fighting or you definitely could not really put together an orchestra that could play Rite of Spring, for that matter, throughout those years. So you had to go much smaller if you wanted to create something. And also, of course, the financial situation there. But the other reason for it not being played is the scandal, partly. And also, I mean, I think you just need time as a society, as an audience, to go like, oh, well, okay, oh, yeah, I remember that scandal, but now let's just listen to this now and appreciate it for what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think it happens often with music for the stage, music written for the stage, that when you hear it just in a concert setting, you actually have a better chance at appreciating it for what it is, for the musical qualities mm-hmm. of it, right? Because everything else doesn't kind of get in the way. You're not preoccupied with the choreography, with the
virgins
costumes.
Being sacrificed.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's none of that.
And somehow the story sublimes as well. You know. You don't get it like kind of like right in your face. Rather you hear what's happening in the music, and then you know, of course, your appreciation grows for it.
It is quite stunning. We're going to listen to a portion of the last movement. I think, was it Gustavo Dudamel said that Stravinsky wrote the first hard rock or heavy metal? This is what he described as heavy metal.
I wish I could come up with sound bites like that. It sounds so great, except heavy metal bands could never play these rhythms.
I found a quote in my research. It said, even by contemporary standards, Stravinsky's harsh dissonance, complex rhythms, and repetitive melodies still seem avant-garde. There's a palpable sense of disconnect as well, an unsettling step into a world governed not by human emotions or reason, but something else altogether. Stravinsky himself once said, quote, there are simply no regions for soul-searching in The Rite of Spring.
I think that this whole way of detaching himself from his own music, the way Stravinsky was really existing as a composer or working as a composer, somehow he always writes a musical picture of something and not the thing itself. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't go into these, even in the earlier pieces like the early Russian ballets, he doesn't go overly romantic. There's mm-hmm. no, I don't think there is any soul searching at all in his music. Yeah. And this is the perfect example of that. I mean, this really is a picture made of sounds of this really, really strange story.
And that's how he described the writing of it. He said it just flowed through him. He was just the vessel through which The Rite of Spring flowed. And you can hear it live. Everyone should hear it live. The recording is fine. Nothing wrong with the recording, but you need to be in the same room with it.
It's amazing energy.
Yeah, what's it like for you as a conductor with all this energy coming off the stage?
You know, if I could describe it, I'd probably go into becoming a psychologist for conductors, which would probably be a good business to have. I don't know. I really don't know. It's really halfway in between being a dancer and being an orchestra musician, because mm-hmm. you're creating the sounds, but also to be able to conduct this piece, you just gotta have your own choreography worked out really well, especially for this section that we just heard at the end of the piece.
How do you not just collapse at the end of that?
Collapse.
Fall off the podium, crowd surf through the Von Braun Center.
As the audience jumps on its feet, you do collapse.